I'm not sure when it started to deteriorate. I guess lately most of it's written by the CUNYIS graduate students who aren't completely, it's not completely worthless, but. But, you know, I mean, and it's piecework. So the most intelligent, smart, and learned graduate student would not display their learning very thoroughly under those circumstances. So if you get a few bucks an article, you tend to bang them out about as fast as you can. Anyway, you could look up Usher in there and see what. But, so here's this history of the Earth with stories about the formation of sediments and the various kinds of volcanic things. And it's unavoidable that there's going to be a history of living things with it because, as you know, associated with these different geological forms are very often bits of stuff having the characteristics of the remains of plants and animals. So shells or bones or something, planty type stuff. And that some of these things don't look quite like anything anybody's ever seen. I don't know on what date those huge bones found in the limestone of the Paris Basin are found, but at some time later in the 18th century, like in the 1700s. And If you say these really are the remains of bones, real bones, they're not just accidents or sports of nature, and if you have, because of printing and industry and more geological natural history going on, you now are aware of just zillions of examples of fossils, and you've even got some geochemical types able to tell you about how petrification could happen from a living thing, from the remains of a living thing to this stuff, then it becomes kind of unavoidable that there is an unknown history of living things. And that once upon a time there were things that don't seem to be around anymore. And so now there's this question about the kinds of living things there are, and now we're right down to, do they have a history? See? If you can't say the very idea of a zebra is eternal, and there's always been zebras, and everything, and then just variations on these forms, but all of them oscillating around the ideal zebra, right? If you can't say that, but that once upon a time there were things that aren't around anymore, then all of a sudden there's this problem about the history of things. And notice how this is really philosophical, and I suppose this is, well, by really philosophical I mean really conceptual. All of a sudden there's a problem about species. That is, there's a problem about natural kinds. And I've found it useful, I guess partly because I'm pretty ignorant, or at least not very experienced with thinking about biological things. So this may be a bit simple-minded for those of you that are, but I've found it useful to think of, and this makes it a bit too dramatic perhaps, but if it's 1800, or make it 1830, so that Lyell and Darwin and Lamarck and all these characters are all around, all of a sudden there's this tremendous problem. If species aren't fixed, if natural kinds of things aren't fixed in some way, and therefore stable, oh, sorry, let's put it different way. How can I? The problem is roughly like this. How to give an account of natural kinds of things such that in order to explain how some kinds of things used to be that aren't anymore, and, I should add, some evidence that some kinds of things that are now, or at least a suggestion of it, didn't used to be, although that's a kind of negative evidence, you could say, I haven't found any of those bones yet. Then there's this kind of dual problem. On the one hand, you've got to have a notion of species, or a story about species, in which they're stable enough that like begets like, right? So that, by and large, right around us, zebras have zebra babies, but not other kinds of babies. But not so stable that you can't give an account of maybe once upon a time a whole lot of things not like the things around now. You know, that story about new species. How can you have... So in one sense, people of Darwin's generation and the generation before, because of this history of the Earth and now just very clear evidence of extinction of some kinds of things, and at least the suggestion that other kinds of things like us weren't around once, all of a sudden there's this problem of what is a species. And what kind of story can you tell that will preserve the apparent short-run stability but allow for maybe longer-run transformation so that new species producing things like themselves can arise? You see how this is a problem? If you let go of the stability too much, you just can't explain the world. Because it's... Okay, I won't belabor it, it's obvious. So there is this problem about what is a species. And I suppose in some ways that's still debatable, isn't it? Or not that still. It continues to be debatable. What are the natural kinds of things?
Just had a time in China, their view that that was capable of reproduction was reported in the normally, of course, the experiment was not.
Well, that stretches the, you know, the definition of species. Yeah. You know, so I mean that still is a biological problem.
Well, I'm not up on it, but I gather, you know, there are various sort of working definitions, but I don't know if any of them are fully satisfied.
Well, the one that we use is
interfertility.
Yeah, that they cannot produce fertile offspring.
Well, but you see, you do have. There then becomes a kind of geographical problem. You
That's
line
right.
them up, and these two can mate, and those two can mate, and those
historically
two end ones.
Field force history historically separating the species.
Yeah.
You know, just because they weren't present at the same time, it's not really that totally satisfactory.
Anyway, in some ways, with lots of biochemistry, the problem may go away.
It gets even worse though, because they find more and more. DNA between orangutans and humans, there's still a little difference.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, less significant.
Well, the problem won't go away if it gets changed into something else. Yeah. Anyway, but Darwin doesn't know anything about that. So there we are. And well, the origin of species business has completely to do with how can we account, by the time Darwin's worrying about it, with all this, account for all this variation of natural kinds of things, and what looks like a history of extinctions of kinds of things, and new kinds of things that didn't used to be. In other words, now the history of natural kinds of things is fluid and dynamic. And Darwin, as you know, has a lot of experience as a naturalist, goes on this beagle voyage, is paying particular attention to variation under different geological and therefore environmental circumstances. He's very struck by what he finds on the rather remote Galapagos Islands. particularly amongst kinds of finches. And it's all kind of composting in his brain. And by his own account, it hits him one day what's going on when he is reading Thomas Malthus' Essay on Population. Malthus is writing in the tradition of Adam Smith, and tough, nasty guy that he is, he thinks he's being realistic. Malthus is arguing against welfare. And what he's basically saying is there should be no welfare, no subsistence, abolish the poor law. Although I don't know if it's as strong as abolish, but weaken it seriously anyway. Because it's just an invitation to disaster. What this does is allow those people who naturally would otherwise not be there to breed and to multiply and to make it worse for everybody. And the whole famous Malthusian business about population expansion. And so welfare is a bad idea, Malthus thinks, because it just invites bigger disasters, plagues, famines, and so on. Which will always take care of the population problem if we don't worry about it ourselves. Malthus himself, in a way that may sound faintly reminiscent. A Finnish friend of mine coined the term skeptimistic. Somebody who's skeptical and pessimistic at the same time. Skeptimistic. Well, this is reminiscent, whatever that is. Malthus urges on us, I mean, the only thing we can do, in fact, to avert this kind of continual population pressure is something Malthus charmingly calls restraint. Moral restraint. And just says that we ought to abstain a lot from having babies, that's how we do it. Anyway, Darwin is struck by all this. It's the tradition of political economy that for Darwin discovers population pressure. And Darwin realizes that that will supply the pressure of population on resources, that will supply the natural equivalent of what he knows human beings have known for millennia. That will supply what, in a natural setting, the kind of selection or animal husbandry that breeders have known about from camels and horses and pigs and God knows what all since antiquity. That will provide for a kind of natural selection, and that it can work in just the way that artificial selection does, which is what breeders do. Breeders pick out who's going to get to mate. And there's a lot of knowledge about that which Darwin knows about, and that you can emphasize, you can make certain traits predominant. And Darwin imagines, and I'm sure he has good reason to imagine, that if you kept at this long enough, you might well be able to transform a creature from one kind of creature to another kind of creature. But anyway, he now is quite sure nature can do this. Not intentionally, of course, there's no intention in this, but that this continual pressure of population on resources, plus this gradually changing environment that geology supplies, means that, I mean the timing's just right, means a gradual transformation in the kinds of natural things that prosper, or at least survive to reproduce in the setting. And enough time goes by and you've shifted all kinds of creatures from this kind to a very different kind, though they're related. And some kinds of creatures just disappear altogether. Others endure. And the details are all to be found out by the data. by natural history. Now, it's important to know, if you didn't notice this reading it, Darwin doesn't make too much of it. It's important to know that Darwin can believe all of this in the way that seems obviously to make sense to us. Oh, I'm sorry, of course, the thing I have to throw in is that, however, well, that there are variations, small or large ones, but you only need small ones between offspring and parents, or indeed offspring and any ancestor. And that it's these variations that nature selects for in a kind of metaphorical way. Well, we don't have time, nor do I have the skill to conduct a very good discussion about the problems with Darwin's theory. There are some recognized immediately, others not recognized till later, and this is something that's still ongoing. Another place some of you might enjoy yourselves is in a course called Zoology 400, which is a history and principles of biology. It used to be taught by Dennis Chitty, but I gather now it's routinely taught by the former Dean of Science, Chinnigan, who's an interesting character. I don't know, I haven't had any reports on the course. Dennis Chitty's an ecologist, and so the evolution part of it was very good when he did it. I guess Finnegan's a zoologist of some kind, so he probably does that stuff well too. But there's also a course that I think is open to people who are not in biology, a course that, his name is Scudder. Does anybody know? That's not open. It is open. Yeah. Have you done that?
No.
Oh, it's the stuff I hear back from that course makes me want to go sit there. I gather it's just great. Yeah. So anyway, if this is interesting at all, go there. But it is important to notice just one thing anyway, that Darwin does not have anything like a neo-Darwinian or modern notion theory of inheritance. You see, in the middle of all of this, you got to have something to say about inheritance. And that's another way of saying the species problem. How come offspring are like the parent? And for the Aristotelian, this is all at least superficially easy, because it's always the same form. And the thing that keeps parents and offspring and all other relatives from being absolutely identical is environmental stuff, nutrition and whatnot. Darwin, I don't think, my sense of it is Darwin does not work very hard or seriously on inheritance. I mean, a theory of inheritance, I think he probably figures it's something for somebody else to do. But he does subscribe to, though I'm not sure to what degree, to a theory that at the time is called pangenesis. And the basic notion there is that, at least in those things that reproduce with male and female, two coming together stuff, two kinds of the same thing, that material from all of the body parts, from all of the organs, come together and are in the ova or the semen, and that something goes on in fertilization so that what's brought together is material that somehow or other remembers, knows about, has the embryonic characteristics of all the different parts of the body. So that here's material that can make a liver. Maybe it even is a tiny little bitsy liver piece. And that's what happens when there's reproduction. This stuff grows into another adult, and there's some kind of mixing of mother and father stuff. But what this also means is that Darwin is committed in principle, and if you read the stuff, even the stuff I gave you, with any care, or at least with any care in the right parts, you see it even helps him to think about things sometimes, that there can be what we would call, or what is derogatorily called sometimes, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, because these bits of stuff from the body parts have the characteristics of the body part as it is in the adult who is doing the reproducing. So, although you can't chop off rats' tails and expect to get tailless rats, if you have real muscly, strong, healthy, muscly rats, their babies ought to be like that too. I mean, there is a kind of natural-unnatural distinction to be made here. If you just chop the tail off, there's still going to be tail. But other kinds of physiological characteristics can get passed on, even if they are acquired, as it were, in the lifetime of the parent. And some of this surfaces in his discussion about the descent of man, where characteristics acquired by persons during their lives, Darwin understands nature makes inheritable. Among those are various social habits and customs. You can see this is what he must mean when, for example, he's talking about the Fuegians and asks the question back in the 1830s. Notice he's asking all the right questions. How do these people come to be adapted to this kind of miserable and awful environment they live in? They seem relatively happy, he says. They seem content enough. They're not grumbling the way us English aristocrats would if you stuck us down here. And they're happy with an awful lot less, and they are really barbaric. But they seem content enough. They go on from day to day. They're not committing suicide. I think it's Adam Smith, by the way, who pointed out what he thought was the interesting question. How come every Aboriginal culture that Europeans know about does not seem to be cultures in which there's no suicide? How come it's only us Europeans that are practicing such things? And he wonders a little bit about, maybe something a little dodgy about modernity. And the remark he makes, which I recall, I think, almost right, he says that the environment they're in encourages some and discourages other habits and customs and so forth. And the environment produces, as it were, these habits and customs, and nature makes them inherited. That's the phrase. What habit and custom make it omnipotent, omnipresent, and nature makes these things inherited. So there in the 1830s anyway, he's talking as if there's an inheritance of customs and tradition. Yeah.
Did you ever read Cows, Pigs, and Witches?
No.
By Marvin Harris?
I've heard of it, I haven't read it.
It is the ultimate common denominator is this kind of environmental economics. All these customs, worship of pigs, is tied to protein availability.
Yeah. Now, just so you'll notice there's some care and attention needed here, it's entirely possible that Darwin or anyone writing in the 1830s talking about inheritance doesn't mean biological, specifically. Right? I mean, it is a legal term, isn't it? It's an old legal term. And it may simply mean then, and Darwin may himself simply mean then, that which is passed on from parent to descendant, passed on to descendants. And it may be that the notion of inheritance, which we so once you get a firm idea of germplasm or genetic material, which was first proposed, as far as I know, by a physiologist named Weismann in the 1880s. Once there's this idea of genetic material, which is somehow isolated from the present body, except in certain ways. I mean, if I start exposing myself to lots of x-rays, then my genetic material gets socked around. My genetic material doesn't change, presumably, just because I don't have Wheaties this morning or something. Once there's this idea that there's genetic material and that it's forever separate from body material, then people can start talking about a theory of inheritance more and more confidently in biological terms, I guess, right? So when somebody said, I mean, and especially after Mendel, or maybe especially after 1920 or something, whenever all of this gets pulled together into one nice, happy picture about genetic inheritance. But I suspect that if you're thinking about this in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe the very term inheritance is just foggy. You know what I mean? You don't know where to draw what lines, on what grounds. The pangenesis theory certainly doesn't help you very much distinguishing environment from inheritance, right? And yet it's the best theory going. Anyway. Well, why don't we end Darwin and then take a break. When you see, what would be interesting were we able to go on and on about it, it's interesting to look at Darwin trying to apply all these principles of evolution theory to human beings. And it becomes apparent, and I guess this is part of what's interesting about it, it becomes apparent he's not happy. Well, one way to put it, he's not happy just saying, okay, that biological entity, Homo sapien, and we'll just look at all its physiology and so on and so on and so on and talk about that. He seems to think that it's part of his job to talk about all those human characteristics, including what he calls our moral sins. Now, I think if read carefully, what he may mean is this capacity to have a moral sense, not any particular contents. Although a moral sense isn't a moral sense if it doesn't have some contents, having to do with, well, basically that old golden rule business, but regarding others as you. You know, that put yourself in the other person's place stuff. And he wants to show how this moral sense could arise naturally. And as I read his story, which I have to read sort of out of context because I don't study these late 19th century things, Victorian things, it's a story that says this moral sense arises out of some kind of social instinct. And the social instinct seems to have been, a social instinct seems to have been something that he thinks comes about because, well, basically it's survival advantage. We're the kinds of creatures that need each other or else we're finished. That is, we got to cooperate like I guess some other primates do. Or else we don't make it, so. We have instincts of that kind. And there it seems he's prepared just to tell a survival advantage story about it. Right? Did anybody go through The Descent of Man enough to see that?
Yeah, well, I'd rather think that he's a little more strong in his argument regarding our identification with the animal world. Without argument.
Okay,
standing on our own.
Oh no, yes, that's right, there's a continuity. There's a perfect continuity. Yeah. I guess I gave you, because I gave you the whole damn thing, there's also this stuff on the expression of the emotions. Mm. And there, he's quite amazed watching little babies to see how much they are like monkeys or whatever. What's he looking at? Gibbons or something? I forget. Orangutans?
Orangs.
Orangs,
yeah. He also, of course, comments about the idea of can man evolve?
Yeah.
Because of you're no longer having this, you know, interbreeding and selection factors and stuff. And if you don't, you know, always breed for passing on best traits, not just...
There's tons of biology and social policy stuff in there, absolutely. And in fact, he comes out fairly pro-eugenist. I mean, there are these great lines about we manage our cattle with infinite care and wisdom, but when it comes to breeding ourselves up, what do? You know, we're absolutely stupid about it. This is one of those moments when a Canadian enters the world historical stage and sort of disappears again. In fact, you know it's because I forgot the guy's name. Grant somebody. A Toronto journalist wrote a response to an article that appeared. It was the British Association for the Anthropological Association, I think. Anyway, somebody wrote this is 1880s, this kind of fervent advocacy of what he called homey culture, which would be like agriculture or oyster culture, but it would be breeding. Homey husbandry, right? Careful breeding to get the very best. And 1880-something. No, it might have been 1910-something. I'm a little fuzzy about this. I just remember the story, not the date. But I've read it, and it's really, I mean, wow. This guy's absolutely just kind of a modern Galileo, only on the wrong side, maybe. And he makes the mistake, I mean, this is the Achilles heel of it, he makes the mistake of abusing us all for choosing our mates on the basis of old-fashioned sentimental nonsense like being in love. Right? Let's get rational! You know? It's just astonishing and wonderful. This guy's so serious, we're going to all perish.
They were pretty rational, though. They're just selecting for economic advantage.
Well, so Marvin Harris says.
Planned marriage?
You see, if you tell the right story, you see, Adam Smith's utility maximizers,
yeah.
Well, then that's real rational. I mean, if that's what's rational, fine. Anyway, so let's get rational about our breeding. And Grant, somebody or other, whose name I forget, wrote a wonderful response to this, which went along the lines of, if your hero Darwin is right, we've been doing real fine on love, which looks pretty natural. So what kind of newfangled gizmo is this you're talking about? In other words, love, or whatever it is obviously a successful evolutionary product. So if it's not broken, don't fix it. Right? Huh? Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, it's what can this character say? Oh, everybody's using it, but. Part of the point of what I was saying the other day about Adam Smith and so on is that a lot of this so-called social Darwinism is just straight evolutionary social theory that everybody believes. I mean, it is the conviction of the intellectual culture of 19th century Europe.
You still have to rationalize how prejudices that already existed. The other races are clearly with us, nature.
Well, I mean, used to rationalize might be one way of putting it. You might put it a little more sophisticatedly, now that you've read Kuhn, and say that nobody can walk around without theories in their heads. because if you don't have theories in your heads, there's no world to live in. And so it's not so much, I mean, in one sense, rationalization, yes, I'm sure it's handy to have a theory that allows for being superior and therefore exploitative of others. But I think it's also true that it's very likely these things are carried with great conviction. I mean, it's not as if there's meeting on the street and going, isn't that weird what we tell people we believe? But it is believed. And there's evidence. There's evidence that it's the right thing to believe.
I think that Canadian Fellows article shows that these people are confusing prescription and description. The Darwin theory is a descriptive theory of how things are.
Yeah.
Right? So that includes everything, including love and hope.
Well, Adam Smith says his theory is descriptive too, right? So how come he's urging us to be rational? Why doesn't he just say, keep on doing what you're doing, because that's what you're doing? Maybe. Maybe the distinction is a little goofy at some point. Well, but we can talk about that after we have a break. But it's pretty plain that Darwin is trying to translate into biological evolution discourse all that stuff about British civilization, about men who are more gifted in some ways than women who are more gifted in inferior ways. I mean, there's been a lot of there's a lot of, well, a lot of the standard kind of stuff about what are female strong cards and what are male strong cards, and they're the better ones, and so on. There's a great deal of that stuff, and Darwin's very busily making biological sense of these things, or trying to give a biological account of them. And it's interesting in those terms. But it's pretty clear for Darwin that, well, no, it's not. This is the challenging thing that's not clear. It's just impossible to open up the Descent of Man and draw a clear line. You know, where does the biology quit and the social theory or whatever that is begin? And where does that quit and some kind of ethics begin? You know, it's all just one piece. And I'm not so sure I'm not so sure we should take that as some kind of mistake, just simple. It's just all a mistake. Perhaps for the very reason you mentioned, the difficulty about when we're talking about ourselves, the difficulty about enforcing some kind of descriptive, prescriptive distinction. Same problem arises in Kuhn. Is this normative or descriptive? What the hell is it? So it may be that that's a problem that it's a problem that in some sense shouldn't be, is not a problem, or I'm not quite sure how to put it, but it's wrong to say it's a problem.
You could say maybe that descriptive practices can make use of the data of descriptive practices, but it doesn't go the other way around. I mean, you can't start from description and come up with prescription. You have to start with a prescriptive practice to begin with.
Well, maybe.
Maybe Darwin just thinks that you can't separate the social and biological.
Well, he may. I'm sure he may. He may well think that.
Because man is a social animal.
But there's a difference between society as a described organism and society as me being part of this thing, interacting with others, and prescribing, and then that. There's a different approach altogether. There's a different approach to being part of the community and describing the community as a social organism.
Sure, but look,
so social theory is, you know, theory cast in certain terms.
Well, but contemporary discussion about this asks the same kind of question. What do we, as those things biology talks about, as organisms, what do we as creatures bring to the business of living in whatever ways we try to live?
together, which we all do, just about. Right? All that kind of... And one branch of this is all this kind of business about we bring lots of... Well, it's sort of Darwin's story. We bring with us lots of stuff from long ago. You know? Our territorial or aggressive or whatever it is, instincts. Other things.
So it becomes problematic whether we can condemnatory of things like that? Or
it becomes...
What you're saying is it's a purely descriptive thing.
Yeah.
Like this is just the biological fact of the matter.
Yeah, it's like having five toes or something.
We're an aggressive species or something.
Some people claim.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Then where can you make normative prescriptions that you should...
Right.
Punish people for violence.
Right.
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 That's the problem.
Well, yeah. Now, interestingly, probably both Thomas Hobbes and Aristotle supply the answer. Right, what's Hobbes' answer to, hey, let's all just be natural? Right? Hobbes says, okay, but you better run for cover.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, but you better watch out. Sure, go ahead, be natural.
Careful where you go.
Or you say, though this I guess is sort of resolutely old-fashioned, though I think there must be a modern version of this, but only old-fashioned people are working on it, I think. Is sort of resolutely to hold firm on this business about the human arena is that stuff that may know about, but is not interested in some sense, all the biology. In other words, the human arena is beyond creaturehood. It's the arena of what I earlier called rational self-consciousness. It's the arena where we make rules we then decide to obey. And I suppose we can know all we want to know doing that. And I think that's probably the question that motivates a lot of this social biology or sociobiology, that one always needs to be careful asking people to do things that people can't do. So, anyway, we've got to take a break. Okay? Let's take a break and then we'll come back and carry on.
You don't have a skate
board. I don't need one. I don't need one. I want reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have another one that would be short. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Maybe I'll talk to you after class.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and have a break. Yeah, I am. $5. Yeah, if you need change, you can arrange for it. Good, and sign up so that I don't write you a note saying, where's your $5?
This is my second short one. It's a trifle fatter than you like.
It's not too short, but that's okay. Oh, interesting. Good. Okay.
I went to print mine out tonight. My computer went down.
Okay, so why don't you bring it tomorrow?
Okay.
Wednesday. Unless, can I figure it out from this?
No.
No, I
didn't
so.
Even bother printing the whole
yeah,
thing.
Right.
It just went. De-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de.
I understand that.
Bye.
Yes, this enters the legion of.
That I'm inclined. I'd like to leave marks for next time when we're talking about technology and society, and let's do what we've got. What time we've got left tonight? Talking about coup and so forth. But let me first ask, does anybody feel the urge to say something about biology and ideology and social theory and politics and all of that stuff? Is there any kind of lingering thoughts about that? No ideas particularly. Okay. Well, it is an ongoing kind of thing. I suppose the best thing I could say at this point is that if you're interested in that stuff, it seems to me it's a genuine object of intellectual inquiry to ask, for example, what in the world are those sociobiologists saying? There's this book you've probably all heard of called The Selfish Gene by a guy named Dawkins. What are these people saying? This is a genuine object of inquiry, I think, for historians and philosophers, that is, for scholars to look at.